you don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
I'm Bella.
Sorry to interrupt.
Not at all. Welcome.
Is that the lemon tart?
It is indeed. It is.
And what's that one?
So that's our almond tart.
From Japan.
And then it has loads of strawberries on downstairs and dusted with icing sugar. It's really good.
I'm actually hungry, like thinking about it.
Bella, Mackie, and her family have been close friends for 30 or so years. And when you're close to a family, you're close to their food. We all spent summers footsteps away from each other's homes in the Val d'Orcia, swimming, walking, and attempting to read novels between long lunches, late dinners, Negronis in the Piazza in Pienza and Montepulciano. Bella was always present, frying zucchini flowers with me, puring the white peaches for sunset bellinis. There was one night when our children noticed that we had no tiramisu from the night before. When they heard it was in her family fridge, they climbed through the bushes and at midnight broke into their house and took it back. Bella is no longer just the daughter of our friends. She is my friend. When she and her husband, Greg, come to the River Cafe, they know the food they want to eat, the wine they wish to drink, and they always request a quiet table where they can just be together. Ask any young person working in the restaurant about Bella's books, and they'll tell you that Jog On shaped their life in a crisis, or How to Kill Your Family was one of those books they could just not put down. Today in the River Cafe, Bella and I will talk about running, families, Tuscan holidays, and facing everything else. Welcome, Bella.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
What have you been doing? You've been in the kitchen making
Ricciarelli.
The Ricciarelli, we started doing biscuits. We didn't used to do biscuits. We kind of did them in lockdown when we started the shop because people wanted to buy cookies, basically. And then the Ricciarelli are so interesting because you and I both lived so close to Siena, and there's always that trip to Siena that we would take in the summer. And I think that, you know, Ricciarelli are like their hometown biscuit. You go to every bar in Siena, and it's so local, Italy, that if you probably went to a bar 20 miles away, they wouldn't have them. But every single bar in Siena has Ricciarelli.
Hi, I'm Polly. I am a chef here at the River Cafe Pastry Kitchen, and I'm here with the lovely Bella Mackie, teaching her how to make Ricciarelli.
See, they look amazing. I've made them a few times before, but mine didn't look like that.
Okay, so I would say it's probably when an issue of packing it with icing sugar.
Yeah, so does it need to be like 8 times more icing sugar than you think?
Yeah, way more. And then you almost kind of like put a little hat on it. Why don't I show you how to do that, actually?
Yeah, show me how to do a little hat. That sounds fun.
When I say give it a little hat, you kind of tuck it under the icing sugar.
Oh, I see.
So and give it a little dome.
Like, it's like a tree covered in snow.
That is it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think classically it is a Christmas biscuit as well. Yeah. So very good. Very
apt.
And
what will happen to the icing sugar on the top, like the hat, when it goes into the oven? Will it fall down or will it
fall? As the biscuit kind of spreads out and cracks, as you can see with the ones that we've got done, that icing sugar kind of seeps into it and dries that crust out.
Right.
And that's where you're getting the cracking. It's where you're getting the nice, like, little bit of tan colour, like, under the actual icing sugar.
This is amazing.
Two bits you can go wrong with Ricciarelli is not making sure that the meringue's been taken far enough. So it needs to really be, like, a stiff peak. Because it can be quite, like, slack. And that makes it extra soggy.
Or you get that thing where you think the top of your meringue is perfect and you look underneath and there's like water still almost.
It's so sad. So make sure, I'd always take it a couple of extra minutes than you think the meringue. Yeah. And then the second bit is making sure it's compacted and covered enough with the icing sugar and your golden. Compacting enough.
One of the things that I've learned is that baking is your passion, because I think it's very interesting. Why does, you know, Polly become a pastry chef instead of a cook where she could make veal shins and everything? There's a love of baking and pastry. What is yours?
I think it's pastry and baking because I find it so intricate, and I feel like the intricacy of it, the kind of layers and the steps and the fiddliness of it really takes me out of my brain for a while. So I always, if I feel anxious or overwhelmed, I'll always go into the kitchen. I find myself looking through recipe books and finding something complicated.
So let's go back to growing up with food. And so I know, you know, both your parents worked, both your parents were, they loved to eat. There was you and your sister. So tell me, what was sort of growing up in your household, food-wise, would you say? What are your memories?
So what I can remember from early childhood is my grandpa was a farmer on my mum's side. So we were up in Scotland quite a lot on the farm. And it was very meaty. And it was very traditional. You know, everything.
What kind of meat?
Like, mainly pork and, and beef. But he didn't think that a meal was a meal without meat. So meat for breakfast, meat for lunch, meat for dinner.
Breakfast?
Yep. He had a breakfast.
Like sausages and bacon.
Yeah, sausages, bacon, you know, I mean, he used to have a buffet tray where there was, you know, every type of meat, there were eggs. I mean, it was, he was a big eater, so it was, you know, it was a big tray.
And we presumably you had somebody cook that, or did he cook it, or did you have a grandmother?
My grandma, my mom, like everyone would muck in and cook, and then it would be presented to all the cousins. It was a big family, so we would eat. There would be a lot of food, and very big on potatoes, Scotland, because he was a potato farmer.
So are we still at breakfast?
Yeah, we're still at breakfast. Fried potatoes.
Really?
Wow. So neeps and tatties, and then, you know, again, lunch was meat, dinner was meat. So that was kind of the traditional food that I ate kind of with my enlarged family. And then in...
Did he live to an old age?
Yeah,
he
was...
On that diet?
Yeah, yeah, 97.
Well, there you go.
Drank a lot of whiskey.
Yeah.
Ate a lot of meat and was kind of an enormous horse of a man. And yeah, why not?
It's fine.
You know? I mean, it's not a coincidence that I would say 90% of his descendants are vegetarians.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? All your cousins?
Yeah, all my cousins, two of my aunts, my mom.
Your mom?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, I became a vegetarian because we were staying on a farm for his 90th birthday, and I looked into the eyes of a cow, and I thought, oh, I can't do that anymore.
Was it that moment?
Yeah, and I
How
never told
old were
him.
You?
25?
Okay.
Never told him because I thought he would hate that more than, you know,
real betrayal.
Anything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then at home... Yeah, they both worked, and I think we ate quite a lot of kind of, you know, macaroni and cheese, spaghetti, you know. But again, the only thing I can really remember from when I was really young is just desperately trying to buy sweets all the time. And I was a really fussy kid, and I mainly only liked white food, so I really liked chips, bread, pasta. And I was kind of really fussy right up into my 20s. I was a kind of really limited eater, and if you'd kind of offered me... I don't know, you know, hummus, I would have said no.
Yeah.
I had such a bland, boring diet of kind of junk food, bread, carby, starchy things. And I was incredibly unadventurous. And yeah, and that took me really into my 20s, which is kind of pathetic.
I have a great story about your mother, which I just remembered, which was that she told me that she once came home and your nanny, you had a young nanny, and you or your sister wanted a biscuit, and your nanny said, if you eat this biscuit, it'll make you fat. And she fired her.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I thought that was so cool because I thought, you know, she's just like, do not ever say that to my children.
Because I was quite a fat kid, though.
Were you a fat
kid? Yeah, I was a fat kid. And I remember actually a woman in a hardware shop that we were in, the owner came up to me and poked me in the stomach and said, you eat too much.
People are crazy.
Yeah, I think I was nine or 10.
Yeah.
So I was kind of a fat kid, and I did eat, you know, an enormous amount of crap, basically. You know, if it was kind of, if it had E-numbers in it or came in a package, my mum would always try and make, you know, food from scratch every night. And yet I really just wanted kind of chicken drumsticks from a packet. You know, I really...
Yeah. So did she make them? Did she let you have them?
Occasionally. Yeah. But, you know, I think she was sort of in despair, really, at like how little I wanted to eat and how limited I was. And once I found something I liked, that would kind of be it for 6 months. You know, that kind of slightly obsessive way of eating, you know.
Yeah.
I'd find something I liked and that would be what I would eat for the next 6 months.
And what about your sister?
No, she would eat anything.
So you would sit down. What would dinners like? Would you all have dinner together?
Yeah, we would all have dinner together. Yeah, we would all have dinner together, the four of us, you know, and he'd come back late. So I'm used to eating late, I think, from my childhood. You know, I now kind of think, 9 o'clock is the perfect time to have dinner.
Yeah. Very Italian, very Spanish.
I love it. You know, when someone says, should we meet at 7, my heart sinks and I think, oh, please don't make me have the kind of early bird special.
Yeah.
So I'm used to eating late at night. And we would have dinner together and And the only dinners I really remember from that kind of period were on Friday nights in the 90s, we would go to Pizza Express.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt so glamorous and, you know, continental. And, you know, it was the first time I had kind of pizza that wasn't from a packet.
Which one did you go to?
Islington.
In Islington.
So it wasn't for a long time. And, you know, in my teens and 20s, I just ate. I can't tell you. You'd be so disappointed if you saw my diet back then. It was kind of buckets of ice cream, grab bags of crisps. Yeah. I used to make myself like bowls of pasta that are kind of, you know, laden down with pasta.
That's what you like.
Yeah, it was comfort food. Yeah. All of it was comfort food because I was quite unhappy.
Yeah.
And so I would eat kind of bland, warm, soft food that could kind of fill me up.
You're going to have a really hard time getting me to judge your eating habits. But I think that it is interesting when you talk to people about babies, you know, sometimes they have their first baby and they go, oh, you know, they just try everything and they eat everything and this is all to do with parenting and how you expose them to food. And then cut to the second baby who doesn't like, you know, maybe like who doesn't want to eat this or doesn't want to eat that. And then they realize maybe you're just born that way, that, you know, even as a little baby, the things you don't want to eat or, you know, a lot of children don't eat fish and then they discover it. When you know, they're older, I think sad. My stepson didn't eat a piece of fish till he was about 40.
And then loved it.
Yeah. You know.
So you're right. Like, we didn't go out to eat a lot. It was Pizza Express, often for like birthdays or, you know, like a special occasion. And then it was quite often the pub.
The pub. Let's talk about pub food. You know. What was that like?
Well, that was pre-gastropub. I guess it was kind of on the cusp of. I remember the first gastropub opening up and people being really excited about it. But before that, it was kind of, you know, bangers and mash, fish and chips.
Yeah. Those and eggs, what are those eggs?
Pickled eggs or Scotch eggs. You never had a Scotch egg?
I did. You can have one. Come on, the pickled eggs, I had a bit of a problem.
Absolutely not.
That might have been a step too far for an American girl.
Yeah.
I wanted to take pictures of people eating Marmite and give it to, I wanted to do a photographic essay because I was in art school of getting Americans and getting them to taste toast with Marmite and seeing the expression on their face.
Is there not an American equivalent that there's kind of a Vegemite?
No, I'd never
back then
seen
there was
that.
Nothing no, like that.
Not in my lifetime. And do you like Marmite? You'd love it, probably.
I didn't try it until I was 35, and Greg made me try it, and now I love it.
Yeah,
but the idea of it back then made me want to hurl, you know. But actually, I can see by your face that you still think it's an abomination.
Richard loved it. Richard, the Marmite on toast and, like, in bed at night, that would be like, oh, no.
Bed at night?
Yeah, Richard ate everything Marmite. In bed. He would always have a toast and Marmite. You know, Richard, he broke all the rules, you know.
That's brilliant.
This is very sweet. But you described living at home and being a fussy eater, but was the baking interesting to you then? Did you want to cook as well as eat?
I always baked from, like, as a very small child. We had cookbooks that were deliberately for children to learn how to bake. Mm. You know, it was always desserts. They never said, you know, you can make pasta, spaghetti vongole. It was always like, you know, and I remember we had a Roald Dahl's disgusting cookbook, which was all the recipes that they make in his books. So it was like Bruce Bogtrotter's disgusting chocolate cake or whatever it was called. So I used to make a lot of those. So I've always baked throughout my life. I've always loved it. And I didn't have any interest really in cooking.
Mm.
So I think my 20s were a bit, I was sad. I was a very sad 20-something year old.
So you'd left school. Did you leave home or did you live at home?
I did
when you
not
went to
leave
art
home.
School?
I was just too unhappy. Couldn't leave home. Mm. Having panic attacks all the time. Couldn't really do very much.
But so you went to art school?
I went to art school in London.
Which one did you go to?
St. Martin's.
Yeah.
But I wasn't very good and I was also very sad. So the two things combined did not do very well for me. So I lived at home until I was 27. Nice. My mum always says that's like the perfect Jewish mother thing of like have your kids live at home, and I'm like you're not Jewish, and she's like yes but Scottish as well, and I'm like I don't think that's true.
So would you still sit down to meals with your parents most nights?
Yeah, but I think there's that funny thing with mental illness, not mental health but mental illness, where your appetite is completely affected by it one way or another, you know. So quite often people overeat if they're feeling sad or anxious or stressed, and the same is true of the undereat. And so food either becomes something that you cling to and rely on. So quite often I would really overeat and kind of gorge on things. You know, I remember driving to this new donut shop and I ate 12 donuts in the space of 2 hours because I felt sad. Why not? You know, I felt sad. But then there would be other times when I would just, food just kind of lost all, you just can't stomach it. And that's so common. So I think most of my 20s, food was slightly dictated to me by how I was feeling at the time. So it wasn't really until I hit my 30s and I sort of started looking outwards towards new cuisines, new experiences, you know, the idea that food didn't have to be stodgy or bland. And now my palate is, I would say, like, if you'd asked 17-year-old me whether 39-year-old me would be eating the things that I eat, she'd have been horrified. Mm. But my food, my diet is completely different.
I'm really interested in what happened to get you out of that cycle. You know, the girl who was in her 20s living at home till she was 26, and then...
I was just so scared of everything.
Yeah.
And I think that partly meant I was unadventurous around things like food, which was, you know, maybe the smallest part of that, but, you know, I didn't fly for 5 years. I didn't get the train, the tube for a decade. Mm. Was uninterested in trying new things. And then I realized that I was very anxious and I needed to do something about that. I did lots of things. You know, I started running. I went to a good therapist. I did all these brilliant things. But I also, part of trying to break free from anxiety is always trying to push back against the anxiety and doing things that scare you, all of those things. And so, yeah, it's not that food scared me, but I knew that I had to start in every element of my life, in every aspect, trying to break out of patterns that I had sort of locked myself into. Yeah, so that just meant I had to try. If I didn't want to try food, I had to try it. So that was my rule.
You did. That was your rule to yourself.
Yeah. Limited, obviously, by the fact that I'm a vegetarian. So if someone handed me, you know, a sirloin. But everything else, I just said, if I don't want to try it, that means I have to try it. That's kind of the mantra. If you don't want to do something,
then
you have to do it. So from that, I tried everything under the sun that wasn't full of meat. And surprise, surprise, that's the thing you learn, right? Is that you're going to like 90% of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's very few things that I tried that I thought, in fact, I can't think of anything that I've tried in the last 10 years that I haven't thought, oh yeah, this is great. Why didn't I try it earlier? I feel so angry with myself sometimes that I wasted so much of my life not eating the most brilliant array of things that now I get to eat and I think, oh my God, you know, my palate was so bored. It must have been so bored, you know. Yeah. And so, yeah, so now I eat everything. And like I say, 16-year-old me would just be like, I don't understand.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With summer fast approaching, life tends to get busy. Seeing family, friends, hosting dinners, barbecues, picnics in the park, and everything else that comes between. What's also important is that we find time for ourselves to rest and recharge. Therapy can be a vital tool to assist you with boundaries and managing your schedule in a way that helps you stay happy and healthy. If you're looking to find a new therapist or start therapy for the first time, BetterHelp is worth a try. It's entirely online, which makes it easy, accessible, and flexible with your schedule. Completing a short questionnaire will match you to the right licensed therapist for you. If it's not working, you can change for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
How much do we love your novel?
Oh, thank you very much.
It's a beautiful, great book. I say how everybody in the River Cafe, when I told them you were coming, has
it's so weird,
read your
isn't
book.
It?
It's, you know, so weird. It's not weird at all.
But it is weird to me because, you know, I still think, in my mind sometimes, I still think it hasn't even, you know, it's come out and I've read it, but it's still really weird to think about other people reading it and you putting something out into the world and then it's not really yours anymore because it's you know, people that love it or people that hate it or people that think you're terrible or... So it's everyone else's reactions to it after a while. So, yeah, it's a very strange phenomenon.
Do you have a routine for eating when you're writing a novel? You have that blank sheet of paper, which is now on your laptop screen. But how do you start the day when you're writing?
So I get up, I have Diet Coke, which is really bad, but that is my favorite. Yep, for breakfast. That's my, it's not a diet thing. It's just that I love Diet Coke. Yeah. I think, is it President Trump? Did he say, I've never seen a skinny person drink Diet Coke? But then apparently he had a Diet Coke butler at the White House.
So you start your day with a Diet Coke.
I start my day with Diet Coke because
Nancy Pelosi starts hers with a chocolate ice cream.
Morning. That's living. Are you kidding?
Every day she has chocolate ice cream for breakfast. Yeah, that's her thing.
Oh, I mean, I aspire to that level of kind of being a grown-up and just deciding that you don't have to live by the rules.
So you have a Diet Coke, because I love it so much.
I love it so much. I've got to give up because it's going to... I'm sure it's like
Somebody
burning...
Somebody said Coke Zero is better for you.
I'm sure it's burning my insides to, you know...
Yeah, maybe Coke Zero. I don't know the difference.
They'll
Somebody
all talk
tell
to
me
Coke and they'll be like...
Just branding.
Just acid.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I have that. Then I have... Normally I have yogurt and granola. Just because it's easy. And then for lunch, I will have salads, like big salads full of like...
So you're home most of the day.
Yeah, that's the worst thing is that I'm writing from home. So what I've started doing is going out for lunch on my own.
That's good.
So I run, I have lunch somewhere, you know, like nothing fancy, but I love the Italian delis around Clerkenwell. There used to be loads more, but growing up, those were where we would get kind of, you know, our treats, you know, fresh pasta. That was the only place that did fresh pasta or, you know, amaretti biscuits or, you know, all of that stuff. So if I can, I'll run somewhere and go and eat for lunch because otherwise I am literally on my own all day. And then, yeah, and then I graze all day. So it's like, you know, those Spanish crisps, the kind of olive oil crisps, you know, I'm constantly eating those and I'm eating salted almonds and chocolate. I'm always eating chocolate. So all day long, or popcorn, like there's always like sort of, it's like party food, but it's just for me while I'm writing because I sort of think, do another 500 words and then break and have chocolate. And then whatever I'm eating in the evening, I will always have ice cream afterwards every single night.
So what about alcohol? Do you drink?
I love wine.
You love wine?
I love wine. Again, I'm very controlled about it because I think that's my personality. And with anxiety, you know, that's just how you feel like you have to try and control uncertainty. So I'm never drunk. Like I'm never drunk drunk and I don't get hangovers because I know my limits. But I will always have a glass of wine with dinner. Always red wine.
Really? Every night?
Yeah. I think the most joyful thing in the world is probably a bowl of pasta and a glass of red
wine. Red wine.
Yeah.
So what happened then going back is the, you know, you figured out that you're going to taste food that you had never tasted before and start cooking and trying and experimenting. And then how did that coincide with getting better?
It was funny because weirdly it coincided with a period where I started running and I was still feeling kind of unhappy because, you know, I'd just been dumped basically and I was feeling kind of crap about that. And so I started thinking, I remember thinking at the time, well, I'm just going to lose weight because then I won't, he'll want me still or he'll realize he made a mistake or something. So it was at the same time when I was trying to lose weight and so I was on these three paths. One was enjoying food, one was losing weight and one was running all the time. And I remember there was a point about a year afterwards where I ended up in hospital with tonsillitis and the nurse weighed me and I was quite clearly very underweight for my height, my age, all of those things. And I realized, oh my God, I've fallen into this pattern of restricting. I was eating different food, but I was restricting food and I was running kind of, you know, 8 kilometers a day. And somehow I'd fallen into this kind of disordered eating pattern without even realizing it, which again, it's about control, about being anxious, you know, all of those things. But that felt really sad to me at the time because I remember thinking the joy of my 20s and teens was I never got sucked into that diet culture.
I didn't have friends like that, but
I never weighed myself. Yeah. I never counted calories. I never did any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I'm past 30. I must be past that. You know, I've escaped that one thing that, you know, so many women fall kind of victim to. And then it sort of hit me at about 32 and I thought, oh, it did get me. You know, it's so easy. You know, the moment you start looking at food as calorie containers rather than as kind of delicious or whatever, then the way you eat changes. So for a long time, I was sort of restricting the good stuff, like, you know, olive oil or cheese or, you know, all those delicious things. And I was viewing them more as kind of a treat rather than a, you know, just a kind of way of life or just something you might want to eat. So that was kind of difficult for a couple of years where I thought I suddenly realized that I was sort of seeing food not as an enemy, but as a sort of something I had to, again, kind of control or, you know, manage.
Did you go on different kinds of diets?
I was just really cognizant of how many calories were in things. You know, and once you know that, it's really hard to get out of your head because if you know what a chocolate bar is, you kind of, it doesn't, you can't forget that, you know? So it's kind of, once it gets into your head, it's quite difficult to get out of your head.
It also affects you socially. I mean, the times that I've gone, you know, say I'm not going to eat today or tomorrow, and then you go to a dinner party, you kind of sit a little bit back, don't you? You're not leaning in, you know, you're thinking about, when you found out, was that the turning point when the nurse told you you were so underweight? Did that make you
No, I think at the time I thought, woohoo, you know, look at me. And it's, I think, I just think at the time you can't, when you're in it, and you can't sort of see that that's not okay, really. But I remember being kind of surprised. But no, I think it was kind of meeting Greg and being happy again. Yeah. And not just because I met a guy, but, you know, I'd sorted out a lot of stuff kind of mentally. And yeah, so food became fun again because we were living in East London and there were just so many brilliant restaurants everywhere. And we fell in love over food.
You know?
Yeah.
So what was that like? Tell me about falling in love over food.
It just... there's something so amazing about sitting with just one other person over dinner, you know, be it at the bar or in a booth, and there's nowhere to go, and it's just the perfect atmosphere, you know. And our first date was he'd booked dinner after we went to see a comedy show, which I just found extraordinary because I'd never been on a date with someone who'd taken me for dinner before. And I said, should we go to the pub? And he said, no, I've booked dinner. And I thought, wow, you know, this is incredibly grown up of you. So I think it kicked off from that. We just had, you know, 4 hours in a restaurant that night and fell in love, and he stayed over and never left. And so restaurants were kind of our thing. And then obviously he then got this job where he's on the breakfast show and he gets up at 5:30 in the morning. So he goes to bed at 9, you know. So it kind of, it's a bit of
that's when you like to sit down to dinner.
Yeah, that's when I want to go out for dinner. And obviously by then he's kind of in bed. So it's a bit of a killer. And so we still try and go out like Thursdays, Fridays, you know, Saturdays if we can. And then obviously for special occasions, like we come here. Or so we do still try and go to restaurants, but it's the way we bond. If we fall out, we go out for dinner.
You know, restaurant is a public space, but you see quite a lot of people crying. Not so much in the River Cafe, but our waiters will tell us that they've experienced people crying over dinner. People get fired in restaurants. People get proposed to in restaurants. And people, as you say, is very often... people go to make up, you know, we're being taken care of. We don't have to get up and down. We can just be served. And I think that's, waiters, you know, are very sensitive to that.
And that's what skill we like in itself, a restaurant, isn't it? You know, to know kind of, to be able to intuit what sort of mood people are in.
Yeah.
But I think, there's something, especially after COVID where we were all stuck indoors and everything, you know, if you were with someone, you were sort of lashed to them, you know, and there was sort of no mystique and no separation. You know, sometimes you have to go away from someone to miss them or, you know, or go out of the house. So, you know, in a way, it's now more important that we get to spend time away from our house because we've been in it. We were in it for such a long time. And so it does act like that reset where you kind of go, it's like we're dating. Yeah. You know, we're on a date here and it feels really special. So we still do that. And Greg is a massive foodie. So we do.
He is, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is. Like he's one of those guys, he'll eat anything and he can kind of be in raptures about, you know, what he ate for dinner the night before and talk about it.
And remember it. I'm amazed at people's food memories. As you're talking about your first date, you know, that people can remember what they cooked to seduce a girlfriend, you know, or what they cooked when they were told somebody had died, or what they told that they can... It's a bit like music. If I listen to a song, you can sort of remember where you were when you heard that piece of music.
Yeah, and then there are things that
you... remember the mood you were feeling, and food is like that, I think.
Yeah, there are things that, you know, sometimes if you were heartbroken and you'd eaten a lot of something, you can't eat it ever again.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you were falling in love and you remember something. That's completely true. There are there are things that are evocative of a time. I remember this pasta sauce I used to make that I just can't make anymore because it reminds me of being sad at a time in my life, you know, And conversely, I think the reason I ate 12 donuts is because my first memory is of my sister being born and my dad buying me a donut in that kind of, your sister's here, please don't kill
her. Life is gonna change.
Yeah. So I remember going to the hospital. My mum said, here's your baby sister. And I said, look at my donut. You know, like, look at this amazing thing that I've been given. And to me, that was kind of the best day, but nothing to do with her. It was just to do with the fact that I'd got this amazing thing. So,
How old were you then?
2.5.
Yeah, so you can remember that.
Yeah, I can remember holding it.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I was so excited about this, you know, sugary bun. So maybe that's my formative memory, is, you know, having to be told my life was going to change forever. And but sugar
will help you through.
There's no one else in my life that has a tooth as sweet as mine. And when I was 7, I came back from the dentist with a gold tooth because the dentist said, that is an adult tooth and it's going to rot because she eats so much sugar.
So much sugar.
So they gave me a gold tooth for a year to protect it. And it's never gone away. My mum once, she said, I'll give you, I think it was £100 if you don't eat sweets or chocolate
like
for an entire...
I like bribery as a form of parenting.
Bribery as a form of parenting.
Richard used to say, if you don't, if you pee in the toilet, I'll give you, it wasn't £100.
10 quid or whatever,
Just pee in the toilet.
Yeah, just please. And they do, because even kids understand, you know, money. But it was 100, I think it was 100 quid, which was a lot of money for a year, for me not to eat sugar. And I think I did about 8 months. And then, this doesn't speak well to my character, but I just realised I could cheat.
Yeah,
I just realized I could go to the sweet shop and be like, I've not had any sweets. It's great.
That's a result of you know, parenting and bribery. You could learn how to
exactly if they're teaching you bribery.
I'll meet you with them.
Yeah, you're thinking, well, I'll also do fraud. So it's a slippery slope. But yeah, that for me, it's like I would rather have dessert than mains.
Would you?
Yeah,
yeah. It's interesting. Are there certain desserts that you always go for?
Tiramisu.
Tiramisu, yeah. The tiramisu. Yeah. So you probably stole the tiramisu.
I probably did, but you know what, Ruthie? I think I will just give one addendum to that story, which was that there was a thunderstorm that night. We were all sheltering indoors, and it was my birthday the next day, and you came out with the tiramisu, and you said, this is your birthday tiramisu.
Exactly.
And so it was, in fact, my tiramisu.
Yeah.
So when I woke up the next day hoping to have breakfast tiramisu,
the story's getting
it
worse
wasn't
worse.
In the fridge. So someone in your family had
they
come
went,
and stolen.
It. I know, it's shocking, isn't it? I didn't know that they had taken it back.
I actually think it's quite a dark story.
I think we could get this, maybe some family therapy here and say whether they took what was rightfully yours.
Yeah, I mean, a judge would have to decide.
Or they thought that was rightfully theirs. Mm,
it's a tricky
it's not
situation.
My style, but I'm really sorry for that.
Thank
and, you. Know, I'd make
I've been waiting for that apology for about 10 years.
You have a whole tiramisu. We're doing
thank
tiramisu at the River Cafe, which is quite contentious,
you
know,
say,
to put tiramisu.
Why was it contentious?
Well, because, you know, the Italians often feel that the food that's been transported out of Italy is not really Italian food anyway. You know, carbonara, they say, didn't exist in Rome. Like
sure,
the mythology tells you that it was the workers. But it was something that, you know, so I put cheese and butter into penne and called it carbonara in America. And I think tiramisu really was an invention of a chef either in France or in the United States.
Are you kidding?
It was not. But, you know, in the end, what we thought is it's actually really delicious.
Yeah.
You know, if you have one that has too much coffee or fake rum or not enough beaten mascarpone, so it's very light. But if you actually think that what you're having is coffee, alcohol, and mascarpone cheese and sugar and cocoa, it's pretty yummy. And so we do it. And people like it. We call
who
it River Cafe's tiramisu,
like
you know. Does Greg, does he like sweets?
No, not really. Yeah. And I've stopped baking as much because I work on my own.
Yeah.
And Greg doesn't really love baking. So I make, there are a few things I still make. I make French flan quite a lot.
I love that.
Oh,
is
so
that,
nice.
Are you talking about like creme caramel?
Yeah.
I love that.
So, because he loves that, so I make that quite a lot. And I still try and make, you know, occasionally I have an Italian cookbook of recipes of dessert, so I make that, but there's not anyone really for me to cook for.
Yeah.
So then I thought I should do a cookbook called Baking for One.
Good one. Baking for one. You could make one panna cotta.
Yeah, one profiterole.
Well, would a cake then become a cupcake?
Yeah, it would have to be a small... I
don't like cupcakes either. But, that's interesting you don't like...
No.
I don't either.
Well, they were very fatty, weren't they?
Yeah.
You know, sort of 5 years ago, everyone wanted to have cupcakes, but they're just very...
Well, they're very dry. I always think that cupcakes have... I like the stuff on the top sometimes, that really bad icing.
Yeah.
And then you have to kind of eat all that cake quite dry.
Yeah, very
so
dry, very very dense, very... Yeah, no, I'm not a fan of cupcakes. Yeah. But you could do one profiterole, one chocolate eclair.
Yeah.
You know, the measurements for just kind of one... Why not?
That's actually a good
idea. For lonely people.
Because of lonely people. But there was also just the amount of the size of a cake.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say free this week into your Xfinity voice remote.
As an athlete, would you eat before you ran? Would you eat after you came home? Would you have a sort of know what foods would be good as someone who wanted to run?
I think nutritionally you do, as a runner, you get better at realizing what you need the longer you do it.
And what is that? What do you need?
You need protein, you need good carbs, and fats. You know, you need fats. And actually, if you're trying to run and you're not eating enough, your body is going to tell you about it. You know, you can't do it. So if you want to run 10 kilometers or 15 kilometers, you need to be compensating for that fully. So at the times when I wasn't doing that, I was running probably quite slowly, whereas now my pace is a lot quicker because I, you know, because I'm eating actual food. Again, it's like that sad thing of, I think diet culture is being pushed back at a lot by today's, I don't know what you see in your granddaughters, whether they sort of talk about it or...
They talk about it. They're pretty, depends on the age as well. The little ones are just eating. And as a parent, you know, as you know, it's sort of... Food is so complicated, you know, it's just how you nurture your child, and then the child knows that if they reject it, you know, they're kind of damaging you, or, and, you know, we get, you know, same thing in the restaurant, you get people who want obsessed with food, so they want to cook, but then they also have eating issues, you know.
Overlap must be, it must be quite high, you know, higher than other industries of kind of people that want, because the love part of cooking is, I love you, I want to cook for you.
Yeah, exactly.
But that doesn't necessarily mean you love yourself enough that you want to eat what you've made, you know. And I think that's kind of, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? Because people always call those people feeders in a kind of derogatory way, but actually it's not. It's those people are trying to be as loving to you as possible while not being able to afford themselves the same compassion, which is sort of tragic. So I'm trying to be more compassionate towards myself, and I'm trying to just enjoy the pizza, enjoy the kind of, the baking more, and and I'm still trying to eat everything that I don't want to eat.
How do you get your proteins as a vegetarian?
As a vegetarian, it's difficult, isn't it? I think probably I don't get enough protein, actually, just because I never really know what is, like, what's got protein in it. Like legumes, beans. I'm big on lentils, bolotti.
And rice together, I think.
Rice.
In the Spanish country, in Mexico, they always have rice and beans.
They
say it's the combination.
The best combination. Yeah, I eat a lot of lentils and bolotti beans and cannellini beans and all of that kind of stuff. So I sort of hope that that's going to, you know, that my bones aren't going to sort of suddenly, you know, give up on me halfway. But
do you always think about the eyes of the cow? Same thing with fish. Don't want to go near
I just can't.
What did you eat last night?
Last night I made myself Greek food.
Oh, did you? What was that?
I made myself baba ganoush, tabbouleh, halloumi, aubergine meze. I love doing things with aubergine.
I love aubergine too, don't you?
I love putting it on a naked flame and burning it on
the whole aubergine.
Exactly, for like 15 minutes so that, and suddenly it shrinks, you know, the skin just kind of, and then you can just, the entire inside will just almost already be like puree. So that smokiness is so delicious. And now, that's what I mean, I now cook for myself. Everything is made from scratch. I don't buy anything.
So you go to, where do you shop?
It's an amazing shop called Phoenicia, and it's a Lebanese supermarket just down the road from us. And there was one day when Yotam Ottolenghi name checked it in a in a thing about where he buys all his food, and he said, I buy all my food at Phoenicia. And I tore it out and I took it down to them because I was like, they're going to be so excited. And I gave it to the guy, and he honestly eye rolled at me and pulled out like a stash of them, and every person morning I brought him this thing about Ottolenghi, and he was like, lady, we know, and now it's laminated in the window, because you can buy, you know, spices that you've never heard of, you can buy brilliant fruit and bread, you can buy Mediterranean meze. I mean, it's it's amazing. So
it's
yeah,
such a change. I mean, we'll go back to politics and how much we need culture, other cultures. We need you know, the idea of Brexit or closing our doors to people who are going to teach us how to cook a new food or eat a new food is just so crucial to a city. I did a conversation with Autumn, and though he and I cook in very kind of different, my recipes are shorter and his go on pages ingredients, and they're so good, and he's so good. And I think that opening the door for people to have ingredients, to try different foods, and to have different cultures is something that's changed a lot. When Rose and I did our first cookbook, people would always say to us, well, it's all very well to put a salted anchovy on your recipe, but where are we going to get them? And now, of course, also with the internet,
you can
order everything. You know, you can get, if you can't get it from your local place.
Yeah, because I remember even sort of 15 years ago, people used to sort of, the sort of cliche about Ottolenghi was, where are you going to buy all of this stuff?
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, now you would be easily able to buy that stuff.
When you cook the mezze, you have no trouble getting...
No, nothing. And that's because I live like on a kind of bustling multicultural part of town, which has all of those kind of amenities, which is amazing. But my mum said, going back to your point about sort of, you know, restaurants and shops and stuff, my mum said that, you know, they hadn't had proper ice cream until there was a kind of Italian immigration sort of drive in the 40s and 50s, and lots of Italians came to the village where she grew up and opened an ice cream parlor called Bizocchi's. Mm. And suddenly they were having gelato in like 1955, you know. And she said, when we were growing up, she said, you have no idea, there were not restaurants like there are now. You know, this idea that you'd go out to a restaurant, just it wasn't a thing that you did. Whereas now, you know.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So I guess that we've been through, you know, cooking for our own mental health and not eating when we're hungry or eating when we're not hungry, or food and family and babies and donuts. And so I suppose the food is all that, and it definitely is memory. It also is comfort. Mm. And so I guess my last question to you, as I ask everyone, is there food that you turn to specifically when you feel you need comfort?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? Yeah, my mother makes mashed potatoes, and because I love her so much, that is kind of the thing that I want to say, is just I would make mashed potato in honor of her, but I wouldn't do it as well as her, so I think it would make me sad. So I think I'm going to say that at my saddest moments, when I really felt like the world's falling down, or when my family have needed to come together for things, you know, to sort of support each other through grief or sadness or whatever else is going on, it's always pizza. So I'm going to say a really good pizza. And when, because it's so communal, everyone's eating the same thing, you're sitting around these boxes, it feels very informal. And that feels to me, that feels so lovely. You know, everyone's sort of scarfing it into your mouth, no one's speaking because you're sort of enjoying it so much. And it's gone, you know, like that. So yeah, you're not, there's no ceremony behind pizza. It's definitely a kind of, it's like the sweatshirts of food, you know. So that would be my choice. That and then ice cream. And then I'd be happy.
Then we're happy. Yeah. Well, I hope you don't need to go for comfort, because I just want you to be happy.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure.
All my love. Yeah. Thank you, Bella.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.